Welcome, everybody. How many people have read all of Mary's books? Show of hands.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Wow, take a bow.
How many have read two or more? Two, at least two. Okay. How about the newest one? Has anyone completed that one yet?
Excellent.
Awesome. Welcome. I just wanted to start real quickly. You talked, I know you did most of your book tour, a bigger part of it in June, you'd mentioned.
Yeah.
But you've been on the East Coast and getting to enjoy summer, or I should say fall now that we're finally here.
Uh-huh.
Has it been nice to be back in fall? I know you grew up on the East Coast and being able to experience our seasons, even though it's going to get warm again.
Oh,
just a day or so.
Yeah. I mean, people I live in the Bay Area, and you hear people saying, oh yeah, we have leaf changing. I'm like, we do not. It's pathetic. There'll be like a little, oh look, there's a little bit of color. Because you don't have just like hillsides of pink and yellow, and those really just, it's wonderful. I love coming to the East Coast in October.
Awesome. I know you're only here for one day, but you did get to walk around and get some good coffee, so
yes. That's
a good thing.
Yes, I went to the lab.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, this is a very quick cursory question, but doing this book tour with our stressful campaign that's going on right now, has that added any layer of stress to doing book tours or any weirdness being out with the public at all?
Not really, although there was a period of time when I was on book tour. There is a chapter that had to do with the development of a stink bomb. Anyway, and I had this sample of something called stench soup that was developed at Monell Chemical Senses Center, and they sent me the sample, and I was like, I'm a little nervous to open it. So it sat in the closet for a very long time, and I was sort of traveling around with it, thinking like, what would be the most appropriate place? And it was around that time, like of the Republican National Convention. I was like, maybe we'll open it here, but that didn't happen.
Good.
It's not a political book, so no, it hasn't really. It's just that it's on everybody's minds, and it's a topic of conversation everywhere you go.
Yeah.
But not really in a formal way. Yeah.
That's good news.
Except for the stink bomb.
Just to dive right in, because especially I actually just reviewed that chapter, so I knew what you were talking about exactly. What was the thing that led you to this topic? Was a particular event or a story that got you that you decided to pursue it?
Yeah. Well, it was kind of an unusual pathway into military science. I was reporting a piece for Smithsonian Magazine, the food issue, on the world's hottest chili pepper, which is grown in Nagaland, which is a state in the extreme northeast of India. So I was reporting a couple of things over there, but I was there doing that, and somebody said while I was there, this chili pepper, the Indian Defense Ministry made a non-lethal weapon, kind of a powder that was sort of, you could set it off and clear a compound or disperse a mob, similar to pepper spray, something like that. And I thought, well, I should report on this. That's kind of curious. And so I went over to this lab that was run by the Indian military. And while I was there, I was sort of poking around. And they were working on a leech repellent, I remember, finding fascinating that somebody would need to develop a leech repellent. But I guess if, you're making your way up a river in monsoon season and leeches are coming at you, being in the military, often you're kind of like an extreme backpacker or extreme hiker, so you're dealing with all the elements and all of the nature and heat and all of this. So it occurred to me that military science was a broader and more esoteric realm, and that it was kind of a roachable thing, and that there's just a lot of kind of behind the scenes and stuff that's sort of under the radar. Because when people think about war, they think about combat and the high drama, life and death kind of things that get turned into movies and memoirs and things like that. But there's a lot of kind of interesting things going on that don't get covered. So that was how it
Started
came about.
Chili
yeah,
pepper.
And I heard around that time from a retired Army pathologist who had written to me because he had read Stiff. And I said, hey, I'm kind of thinking about military science, but I think the access would be too difficult, so I probably won't. He said, no, I don't think you, I think you should go ahead. And he offered to introduce me to, the first place I went for the book was the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System, the mortuary and the morgue in Dover, which is, it's a really sensitive place. It's not a place I would have imagined that it is that easy to visit. And he introduced me there, and they, you know, they were very welcoming and agreeable. Yeah. And I thought, and that ended up actually being it was the first place I went. It's the last chapter of the book. Yeah. But you know, he introduced me to some people, and it led me to feel like that this actually, I mean, it wasn't easy in terms of access, but it wasn't nearly as difficult as I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned that it's not a political book and that you weren't going to be focusing on so many of the issues that you mentioned, like PTSD, that's been covered so well other places.
Right.
Did you have to work to keep that out in terms of the scientists and the people that you met? Would they talk about that kind of... You know, different units, having feelings about different units and just things like that.
Well, I didn't spend a whole lot of time with the VA in the VA hospitals. I was spending time at places like, you know, the Naval Medical Submarine Research Lab or the Military Entomology Department at Walter Reed or, you know, kind of the, you know, the not combat related quite as much. So no, it wasn't difficult to... you know, it was because that's more the aftermath, and I was more dealing with the science of, you know, like the science of extreme heat and heat stroke and flies and diarrhea and sleep deprivation and stress and fear and, you know, all the things that someone has to deal with when they're deployed. And PTSD is a little bit more of a, you know, aftermath. Although, you know, I mean, it was, I thought about covering it. I didn't find a way into it that, kind of that worked.
Yeah. Well, I just remember one of the descriptions was of the different trigger finger covers for you know, environments.
Oh, there's a footnote. Yeah, right. Yeah.
So with the going out on the tour, have there been any particular chapters or topics from the book that have really resonated with your readers so far that you've been hearing the most questions about?
Well, my readers being my readers, I think interviewers, you know, for radio interviewers, the two things I'm always asked about are it's the maggot chapter and the diarrhea chapter. So people kind of think like, oh, that Mary Roach, all she ever writes about is poop, and it's like, no, that's what everybody asks me about. So it seems as though that's all I write about, but that's all I seem to talk about on book tours because everyone asks that question, and. Anyway, so those two topics come. And I also find that the first half of the book, those topics I get asked about a lot because, you know, who has time as an interviewer or a radio personnel to read a whole book? So it's always sort of skewed toward the first
towards the beginning
of the book. And the poor, like the submarine chapters, nobody ever asks about. Yeah. Nobody ever gets to the submarine chapters. It's like, wait, don't you want to talk about the submarine?
Well, I was also going to ask about the genital chapter. That one had some interesting, I mean, the fact that the VA is even thinking about this finally and the implications that these things have on soldiers and families.
Yeah, that was fascinating. Yeah. There's actually two genital chapters. I started out, I went to Walter Reed to talk to a surgeon, a urological trauma surgeon. In other words, somebody who's dealing with, Well, let me back up. There's a lot more these days, a lot more call for genital reconstruction and repair and surgery for two reasons. One, explosives that one would step on are much bigger now. It used to be landmines, which would, you know, landmine would hopefully just be a below the knee, sometimes above the knee, but rarely all the way up to the pelvic region. And now, IEDs are much, I mean, the buried explosives are much bigger, and the emergency medical care is better and faster, so far more men are surviving to need reconstructive work and even transplant. I have a chapter on penis transplants, and so I was at Walter Reed, and I was in the operating room. They were repairing a urethra, which was a fascinating a procedure because they take a you know, the urethra is the tube that you pee through, and they took a rectangle from inside the cheek. Because it's not only it's hairless, and that's important because you don't want minerals from the urine building up on hair, so you wouldn't want to use a piece of skin from here. And it's also, unlike the forearm, which is sometimes used in the exterior of the penis, it's the inside of the cheek is built for moisture. It doesn't degrade on moisture, so that makes it much more likely to last and there not to be complications. So the surgery itself was fascinating, but then. Talking to some of these surgeons afterwards, they were talking about how there's no one on staff who's a sexual counselor, sex therapist, intimacy counselor, whatever you want to call it, there isn't one, and there's a tremendous need for it, not just in somebody who has injuries to their genitals, but a lot of these injuries, people are on painkillers and antidepressants and things that interfere with the sex life. Also, just if you're, say, you're, you know, one hand and one arm missing and part of a leg, what sexual positions work? I mean, there's just, and there is information and there's resources and there's things you can buy, a tremendous amount of help that can be offered, but there isn't anybody to talk to them. Mm-hmm. So there's some really great people at Walter Reed who are fighting to get a staff position because they've just been doing it on their own time. And I said, is that a budget issue? Is that why there's not someone on staff? And they said, well, yeah, it's budget, because part of it is that that's seen as a lifestyle issue. And these guys, like, there's one surgeon there, you know, he's like, you know, because they'll say, you know, it's not that important. And he'll say, well, you know, why is it that important that they walk? Put them in a wheelchair. And people go, it's important that they walk. And he said, it's important that they have sex. You know, and I asked one of these women, what is the, you know, this woman who's been doing it on her own, I said, what is the divorce rate like among these veterans? And she said, divorce rate? Let's talk about suicide rate. So just, you know, some really heroic people there just taking it on as something. I mean, and I hope, I've been talking about it a fair amount in interviews, and I hope they're able to get approving, billeting it's called, I guess, to create a full-time staff position or more than one. I mean, obviously, during, you know, it's the drawdown in Afghanistan. There's not nearly the need for it now that there was, you know, a few years ago. Yeah. But, yeah.
Well, it's interesting because I'm sure as you went through it, you found that you probably discovered topics that you would not have even thought would rise to the top.
Yeah, yeah, right. You don't think about that kind of injury partly because it's not visible. I mean, you see someone with a titanium limb or, a hand prosthetic or burns, and it's visible, and you see it when you just you meet them, and you don't necessarily see, you know, a urogenital trauma, as they say. You know, it's kind of and it's because it's private too. It's and it's not an easy thing to bring up. It just tends to stay hidden, and it should be something everybody feels more comfortable talking about and doing something about. Yeah.
So, in general, have you ever found a fact too disgusting to write about? And with that in mind, are there any topics or books that you want to write or a publisher just hasn't wanted to get on board with?
No. No and no. I'm trying to think what could be more disgusting than what I've covered. because I think that The topics that I cover, there is an element of grossness sometimes, but what I love about writing about some of these taboo or gross topics, since people tend to turn away, whether it's like oral processing, you know, like how you chew up food and turn it into a bolus and swallow it, or you know, some of the lower down digestive things, people tend to turn away and they don't want to think about it. So it doesn't get a lot of coverage, and so people, people end up surprised, and they end up learning something about it. And so I want to, with my writing, take people from, I thought this was just going to be gross, to, it is gross, but it's really interesting, and sometimes important, you know. And so these taboo topics, because we don't talk about them, sometimes it is important to talk about them, and it helps, you know, if you have some sort of issue with, like, you know, Gulp had a chapter on fecal transplants, and this was back when nobody had heard of them, or very few people had heard about them, and they were kind of like, what? That must be illegal. You take somebody's shit and you put it in somebody else. You know, and so because it seemed sort of like such an upsetting thing, there wasn't much conversation about it. A lot of people didn't know it was out there, and it happens to be, if you have C. diff, if you have, which is a potentially fatal and occasionally really difficult to treat with antibiotics. If you have that, fecal transplant is something like a 95% cure rate with generally no side effects, and it's cheap, it's shit, you know. So it's this rare bird in the world of medicine that it's effective, no side effects, and it's cheap. And so many people were going without it because there just wasn't, it was so low profile because it was kind of, ooh. The other thing going on, it wasn't just the ick factor, but it was also, because it's just shit, there's no drug company to spend the money to do the clinical trials, to do the studies, which are very expensive. There's no device maker or pharmaceutical company who had that money. So, there's somebody who's, has encapsulated, made a pill or 13 pills. I mean, it's a lot to swallow.
Yeah.
And part of that is because it's entered the national dialogue and people understand how useful it is. And now suddenly, the probiotics and it is a form of intense probiotics. Up the butt probiotics. Well, now you can swallow it. But so now it's kind of trendy even.
Well, like,
everybody's getting a fecal transplant.
It is, because I remember the first time I read about it and I was a little obsessed and I talked about it a little too much with friends and they were...
and me both,
but
baby.
When you read that article, or the one article I remember reading, that it was, they were friends and they did it themselves.
Yes.
But this man had been like in crippling pain for
years. Yeah,
and it was like on a dime.
It's on a dime. The guy that I went to Minneapolis, one of the MDs who's been doing a lot of the clinical trial work and the studies, Alex Korutz, I was there for the procedure, all the way through, like the guy coming, the donor coming in with this like brown paper bag, handing it off in the morning and saying, "Not my best work." All the way through to the following Sunday. I mean, I think the procedure was on a Friday, and he wrote to me on Sunday and said, last night the patient had a solid bowel movement. I mean, that's not everybody's idea of an exciting Saturday night. But for this guy, it was huge.
Yeah.
I mean, he had to quit work. He was on disability. I mean, it was like that, so.
And you're hearing, hopefully more people have
heard
about it.
Well, hopefully that it'll turn out to be useful for other, like irritable bowel or some of these other. Yeah, exactly. And it, and again, not many side effects.
Yeah.
I mean, they make sure the donor doesn't have a communicable disease, but normally not.
Yeah.
Tremendous worry about side effects. Yeah.
Curious with some of your other books, can you talk a little bit about what led you, and what your process is, I guess, if you sort of decide that you're going to tackle a topic or, if you stumble upon it, or if it's both?
Yeah, well, it's different with every book. I think sometimes it's that ideal kind of fairy tale situation where you're reading something or talking to someone and in an instant you know. And that was the case with Bonk, which is about sex labs, bringing people into a lab to study sexual physiology, which is awkward. Particularly in the 50s when Masters and Johnson did that for the first time. So that was a situation where I was reading or flipping through an issue. So I don't remember where I was, but it was a copy of Film Quarterly. And they mentioned the colposcopic films of Masters and Johnson, just a passing reference. And I thought colposcopy is like a cervical biopsy. I mean, I kind of had a sense, like, this sounds kind of like they're filming inside a woman's body. And then I thought, well, if you're documenting female sexual response, there's some stuff going on there. How do you see it? Well, I guess you could make a penis camera with a small light source and have a woman have sex. And I was like, wow, sex research, that'll be my next book. Because it was such a, seemingly bizarre and unthinkable laboratory scene. But on the other hand, kind of ingenious and amazing and courageous, to set out in the 50s to document human sexual response. It never really had been studied, arousal through orgasm, the whole thing, what happens in the 50s, and to present yourselves as what they were. Masters was a respected scientist, with a lab, white coat and everything.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was just fascinating. That's why I was interested in the history and also how it's still done today and what is being researched. But that was just that moment where I thought, oh, yeah, duh.
Yeah. What about Gulp?
Gulp is one of those books. It's the subtitle is Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. So it's just, and I love, even though alimentary is a word a little old timey, and like there are people who don't know what it is or how to pronounce it, as based on many radio interviews. I love the idea of it sort of seeming like a tour. Down like on the Panama Canal or something. We're on the Alimentary Canal. So I wanted that sense of travel and wonder and curiosity. It's not really about digestion and absorption and dieting. It's really just a trip down the tube with various unusual stops along the way. Yeah. And that's just a case of me thinking, that's an, I don't know, just occurred to me, that's kind of an obvious topic for me. Because not just from the waist down, which is really obvious for me, but I found that there's this place in the Netherlands called Food Valley that had a whole department where they'd study oral processing, which is how do you turn a piece of food into, you know, you, this is what you do, and you put it in your mouth and you break it down and you moisten it and then you put it back together in the swallowable state, you know, like, which I kind of think of as Rhode Island or something. And so that, you know, the fact that somebody studied chewing and somebody studied oral processing and bolus formation and swallowing, which is a really complex physiological phenomenon, and you don't want things to go wrong in there. Two tubes, kind of sort of like a rail yard switching. You know, if it gets down the wrong track, that it can be bad either way. So just the fact that there's scientists, there's people who study that, and various other things. Rabbit holes I went down. Yeah. It just seemed like a perfect topic for me, and so that was that. That's how that came up. Okay. And then packing for Mars had to do just with I'd been reporting at Johnson Space Center for a Discover story on how they train for spacewalks, and I'd also years ago interviewed an astronaut who was an MD who studied bone loss because that's a problem in zero gravity. You don't use if you don't use your skeleton, your body tends to kind of dismantle it. Like, we don't need this anymore. So bone loss is a big problem. And he, we'd supposed to be talking about osteoporosis, but we went off on a tangent. And he was telling me about this video toilet, like a toilet with a video camera pointing up and a closed circuit TV of like your butt, which was helping astronauts kind of dock with the toilet because it's different. It's not. It's a whole different system. And they were getting the angle wrong and gumming up the airflow. And anyway, so there's this training toilet. And he told me about this, and I couldn't obviously use it for a Vogue story on osteoporosis, though I would have loved to work it in. But I just sort of tucked it in the back of my head, and I thought, one day I will tell that story. Yeah. So I had that, and then a third topic about the bed rest facility where people lie in bed, are paid to lie in bed to mimic that zero gravity situation, and they look at countermeasures for bone loss. But that, you know, a world where people are paid to stay in bed for 3 months is, who are these people? Right. What is that like? So I had these three chunks, and I thought, all right, I can probably find 10 more chapters that will kind of fit into this, the world of physiology and psychology of surviving in space. You know, it's not a book about Mars. People think because Mars is untitled, it's just it's more about the challenges of being a human being in an environment for which we didn't evolve, and there's just no human system works the way it's supposed to. A lot of things go haywire, and it's a big challenge to keep people thriving. So that was Packing for Mars.
Packing for Mars.
Yeah.
How about Stiff?
Oh, Stiff. Stiff was around that time. I was writing a column for Salon.com, and it had loosely to do with health and medicine in the human body. And an agent had contacted me, had read the column, and said, "Do you think about book ideas?" And I went, "I can't. I'm a 3,000 word maximum. I can't do a book." And he said, "Well, I don't know about that." And he asked me, "Which of your columns had the highest hit rates?" And there were three columns that had to do with cadaver research. And it was his encouragement. I initially thought, that's a really bad idea. Like, who's going to go, what is the scenario where someone's going to walk into a bookstore, look at this table of amazing new nonfiction books and go, oh, yeah, this one about cadavers? Oh, that's the one I'm going to buy. I'm like, who the hell would buy this book? And he disagreed. He said, I think you should write a proposal and let me shop it around. And multiple publishers were interested. And so I was wrong and they were right. It actually was a topic people were curious about. I think before I did that column, I had not written anything about cadaver research or, you know, morgues or anything related to that. Oops, it's not a, it wasn't like a personal passion of mine. I wasn't suckled by morticians. One of those fortuitous situations where somebody kind of plants a seed and off you go.
Yeah. Have you had strange things mailed to you from fans because of some of the topics of your books?
I got a lot of interesting email after Bonk, the Sex Lab book. There's a TED Talk that is based on that book, elements of it. It's 10 Things You Didn't Know About Orgasm. And the TED Talks, they don't say, when they introduce you, that you're an author. You're not supposed to promote your books, or back then anyway, you weren't supposed to. So people thought I was a researcher. So after that talk went online, I got a lot of very interesting email from, like, somebody. I remember a guy writing, "Hello, Dr. Roach, I'm a 49-year-old Greek man, and when I ride a bicycle, I have an orgasm. But I sometimes, I know that it's going to happen, so I ride around for a little while longer, and I'm late for my appointments, and I'm not sure if the anxiety, was this long? Lenny said, I just thought you might be interested." So I got, or like a woman who said, "Yeah, on a good day, putting on lip balm does it for me." Just the most, the takeaway here, people are all wired differently.
Yeah.
So, but fascinating.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody sent anything. I'm trying to think of anybody sent anything. Not so much sent anything, no.
That's good.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, this was just a random. I noticed you had worked in PR a long time ago.
Yes.
At the San Francisco for the Zoological Society.
Yes.
And that your office was near the gorilla.
Yes.
Exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any interesting stories from that time? And are you still involved with the zoo at all anymore?
Well, we were in a trailer right next to Gorilla World. So often people would knock on the trailer door and say, "Is this Gorilla World?" And I'd go, kind of. the zoo was a fascinating place to work. There were just things that the regular zoo-going public didn't know about, like the fact that the muntjacs, which are little antelopes, every night would escape from their enclosure, run around the zoo, and then before the people came in the morning, they'd go back in. Just like little things like that. I was not well equipped. I was the media relations person. When the press called, I took the phone calls. It was just two of us, my boss and me, and I would answer the phone. So sometimes, because the zookeepers didn't get along with my boss very well, sometimes they'd plant rumors in the media, and I would get the calls. Like, I got a call from the press saying, "I understand, I heard a rumor that a cheetah was sucked dry by fleas." And I should have just denied it, because it was, in fact, false. But I didn't deny it. I just immediately was like, how much blood per flea? How many fleas do you think that'd be? And I got in this conversation with the reporter, leading him to think maybe it actually had happened. Like, how many fleas would that take? And is it possible? And because to me, it was just an interesting biological question.
Yeah.
Kind of like that Randall Monroe, what if? That kind of question where you want to go like, whoa, let's see the amount of blood per, And my boss is like, no, deny it, not really well suited to a career in public relations.
Yeah, if you want to get, let's talk more about that.
Yeah.
I was very interested in, you mentioned it earlier, the stink bomb chapter.
Yes.
In Grunt. And then also you had the other chapter, and I'm blanking, that covered smell the nose job in Gulp. Because they both cover smell and olfaction in different ways.
Yes.
We actually have a series of events that we put on here called Smell and Tells.
Uh-huh.
And we have a professional nose who teaches them.
Uh-huh.
And the thing that, and in fact, I'll just say the next one is called Nostalgia, the Smell of Books and Aromatic References in Literature.
Fantastic.
It's going to be Wednesday, October 19th in this building at night. But she particularly asked the teacher because... you cover, especially in the nose job chapter,
yes,
the idea that people don't have words to talk about smells.
Yes.
And that's one of the big things that comes out of these events.
Yes.
Do you feel like that might ever be a topic that you could explore further? Because there is so much more study being done around it, finally.
Yeah. I mean, I've covered it, in two books. I don't know that I would do a whole book on smell. Just I feel like there have been... the Natural History of the Senses,
right.
Diane Ackerman, I think.
Yeah.
There have been a number, and then a book, some amazing book by I think he used to be the perfume correspondent for the New York Times.
Yeah.
Those were the days, right?
Yeah.
And I could afford to have a perfume and a bridge writer.
Absolutely.
And a chess writer. Anyway, I think that there's been a couple of books on the, you know, the fragrance industry, and I feel like it's been covered a little bit, but I like to include pieces, bits and pieces mm-hmm. of it, and it's fascinating. Yeah, that whole, because this woman that I interviewed, she's kind of a forensic nose in right. a way. People would hire her, beer industry, wine industry, some of the food industries as well, but beer and wine were the ones that most often.
Yeah.
She, and so, you know, if your beer had developed, or olive oil, that was the one she was working on, and so she could come in, an olive oil company or beer would hire her if something gone wrong, like clearly the taste yeah. and the flavor, which is more nose, taste is tongue, and flavor is mostly scent, something had gone wrong, it was off, it was a bad smelling batch. She could come in and buy the scent, the flavors, tell you, okay, you've got some dregs in your tanks, your storage tanks, and that's why you're getting this particular off odor. She was just like a forensic nasal detective. It was, yeah. And so she's an amazing yeah. person, and can really, you know, take a sip of a beer, and or a taste of olive oil, and pick out four or five individual scents that I couldn't.
Yeah.
And you know, I had the sense of that's kind of bullshit when people go, I'm getting black cherry and I'm getting tobacco and da 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 da. But in fact, you can learn it, like learning a language. There's these kits where mm-hmm. there's black cherry and here's tobacco and here's, and so you sniff each one and it's like learning the words to a language.
Yeah.
Or learning, instead of hearing a symphony, hearing the oboe and the clarinet and the drums and yeah. being able to hear it by the individual components. So you really can learn it and educate yourself. And the olive oil people
yeah.
were, they had tryouts for an olive oil tasting. And I tried out and didn't even make the first cut. I was like actually thinking this one olive oil was, this is really good.
Yeah.
And it was off. It was rancid. Yeah. It was rancid olive oil. Apparently, your European olive oil companies just unload lots of rancid olive oil here in the U.S. because we don't know. I mean, we're like, yeah. wow, it tastes good.
Well, and I know one thing that was in the stink bomb chapter that has come up in these workshops is how often seemingly putrid smells are actually in fragrances because
oh, yeah,
they
right.
add those notes.
Yes, and also they're context dependent.
Right.
Like butyric acid, I think it was, it's if you take a brick of Parmesan cheese, that's butyric acid, that smell, but it's also vomit. So in a different context, it's appealing or not appealing. Similarly, trimethylamine is a fishy scent. Mm-hmm. So it can be sort of rancid fishy or kind of vaginal. So this one person who was yeah. in the stink bomb chapter, this was back in the 40s, so he had this lovely way of putting it. He said, pleasant or unpleasant, depending on circumstances. So there are these, you know, context dependent and also culture dependent.
Well, that was what I was going to
yeah.
ask you. The cultural thing was very
sure,
surprising.
Yeah. There was this woman at the Monell Chemical Senses Center was the joint non-lethal weapons task force or directorate she was hired to come up with a non-lethal weapon, a smell that would be off-putting, revolting, and frightening to anyone in any culture. And that took some doing. She traveled around the world with these little vials of like sewage, burnt hair, vomit, U.S. government standard bathroom malodor, which is a compound that was developed in World War II for testing latrine deodorants. So you need a standardized, horrible latrine smell. So she traveled around and like she would test it in different cultures, and something like 3% of Caucasians say will rate vomit as a wearable scent. Or there are cultures where sewage smells like something for dinner. It's like, or, you know, I'd eat that. So she'd yeah. say, is this, do you find this frightening? Do you find it appealing? Do you find it wearable? Do you find it edible? And the one that won out, where everybody agreed you don't want anything to do with that, was U.S. government standard bathroom malodor. Like, that is a very off place. So she started with that,
yeah.
but then, because she's a professional malodor developer, this I love this. They took, they added a top note, which is the first thing you get when you take a tentative whiff. When we encounter a new smell, we tend to take a little tentative whiff. So that's fruity and pleasant. So that encourages you on the keeper inhale to inhale deeply, and then you get hit with that U.S. government standard bathroom malodor, and you're like, ah, oh, get me out of here. And it's really, you want to flee. It's that bad. It's gag-worthy. It's really, it's not dangerous, but it's, you definitely want to get away from it. So stench soup was a pretty powerful non-lethal weapon.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, before we turn it over for questions, is there anything you in particular wanted to talk about? I know you travel a lot. Have you gone anywhere recently that, you know, I know you've gone to all of the continents twice.
I did a lot of traveling in my magazine days. No, I did a lot of travel for Grunt. We could certainly open it up for questions if people have questions.
So come on up to the microphone back with Valerie.
And the question's going to be about any of my books or writing or my personal life. I don't care anything, really anything. I'm an open book.
I'll start out. Has there been anything, I noticed when you wrote Bonk, you said you weren't going to try to do you kind of gave a preface at the beginning saying you're not going to go too far. You don't want to like really, you know, put something in the book that's just so gratuitous or over the top, right?
Yes.
So
that was my goal, yes.
Yeah, well, you've written a lot of books that are, you know, provocative, to speak. So is there anything that you'd want to share that you maybe haven't shared on TED Talk or in a YouTube video or something that...
Are you trying to get me in trouble?
No. It looks like an adult audience, I think, mostly.
Well, sure, I'll share. Those are the things that my wonderfully wise editor, when she reads my manuscript, every now and then she'll just cross a paragraph out and say on the side, no. And she's always right. And I'll tell you one. In that book, Bonk, I was in Cairo visiting this researcher, Ahmed Shafiq, and he studied reflexes, sexual reflexes, and he was going to demonstrate this particular reflex. The woman who was going to be the person he was going to demonstrate it on wisely, understandably, took off. So there goes the demonstration. And so he goes, well, we can show you some, I'll show you a different kind of reflex. And so he proceeded to show me a reflex called the anal wink, which is basically, here's your anus. If you scratch right here, it goes like that. It's like, it winks, okay? So he recruited this poor male nurse to like, and he like, the guy stands on the bed, and then Professor Shafiq has his, one of those metal pointers, and he's like pointing and does the thing. And I flashed on, because there's this, we're all looking at this hole, I flashed on as a kid at Easter, we'd get these little sugar eggs with a little, you'd look through the little hole and there'd be a scene with bunnies and chicks. And I wrote this all up in the book, and that just got like, no. So that's not in the book, and now you all know the kinds of things that occasionally get removed, and it's a good thing.
Anyone else?
Hey, I know that you needed to change the order of the genital reconstruction surgery chapter in Grunt, and I was wondering how you think the opinions of book publishers are going to influence writing styles by the direction it's going today.
Oh, okay. Writing styles... Thankfully, right now, the situation is the sales and marketing staff have a lot to say about cover design and title. They don't have, say, at least my publisher is W.W. Norton. They're independent. I don't know. So I can't speak for the whole field. But my sense of it is that it's not like the movie industry where they're telling you, you need to change the ending. My editor's concern was just that that's pretty intense for people to dive into right away. But she was not, they're never making you change it. It's always like, this is what we think is smart. It's ultimately your call, but I really would suggest you lead with a different chapter. I ended up agreeing with her that it wasn't necessarily the best place to dive right into penis surgery on page one. So that's why the order was changed. Just there's a lot of concern about what's the first thing people are going to read when they pick up the book, And will it be inviting, and will it draw them in, or will it scare them away, or will it bore them? So that's a legitimate concern for authors as well. I'm like you. I think it would be a horrible development if publishing went the way that mainstream film has gone, when marketing groups tell, you know, by voting tell you we don't like the ending, or we don't like this, or, you know, and then you end up with this kind of like a little bit homogenized, blandified version of the original. So, and to my mind, that hasn't happened with publishing. I mean, the tone and the voice are pretty much left as they are. But by dint of which books are chosen and which are not chosen to be published, I mean, certainly the direction is determined somewhat by the industry itself. But so far, it isn't an issue in my career. Does that answer your question? I tend to think that it's less. When I dealt with it most was when writing for a magazine, or like, because with a magazine article, you know, the magazine is the product. So you as the writer have to fit your tone to their tone. You have to not offend the advertisers, and you have to appeal to their demographic. For example, Outside Magazine is almost entirely male readers. So there are a lot of voice and style and edits that I've never experienced that with books. Because with a book, you're the product. You know, you're what people are buying, basically, your voice. So I have found it to be much less of a problem. And I don't know that it's certainly I think, you know, if you're an A-list, if you know you're like Philip Roth or something, I think there's probably authors who like don't even get edited. Like, don't touch me, I'm perfect. And no, who's gonna tell somebody like that? So further down, I think you might get more pressure to make changes. But hopefully, if you've written a book proposal in a sample chapter, and some publisher said we like this and we're going to publish it, they should be all right with that, because they know how you write, and they gave you a contract to write a book like that. So it'd be weird for them to come back and say we'd like you to completely change the tone. So.
Hi, Mary.
Hi.
First of all, I really enjoy reading your book, Grunt.
Thank you.
So you know that the first copy that I got is actually left it in Indonesia. I read this over summer, and I like it so much, and I recommended my friend over there to read it. And then last week I learned that you're coming. I'm like, okay,
oh, that's great.
Buy another copy. So
I love that there's a copy of my book in Indonesia.
Yeah. So my question is, if you ever get overwhelmed doing the research, because this is, you know, something to do with military and war. I love the part when you explain about shark repellent, and I wish they found something, because I'm quite phobia towards shark. But there's a part in this book, talk about you went to even a studio in California setting up a war.
Like a simulated scene. Combat
yes,
scenario for training combat medics, yes.
Right, and the way you describe it, I read it and I'm like, wow, she's like in this Rambo movie or something like that. And even all this, you know, the nurse or all this medic seems like they're even like you could tell that they're like, deer in the headlights, basically. So,
yeah.
So if that affect them, I just wonder if that affected you too when you doing this research.
For people who haven't read the book, thank you for your question. There's this big studio, former action movie studio outside San Diego, near Camp Pendleton, where the Marine Corps has a base. And the combat medics are trained what they're trying to do is create a realistic combat scenario with pyrotechnics and sound effects and amputee actors, even with a sleeve of gore and a backpack that's pumping blood at a realistic rate. And these medic trainees have to come into this scenario, you know, like a kinetic scenario with, you know, seemingly being fired at. There's dust hits, so it looks like it's rifle fire. And they've got to come in and say, put on a tourniquet or do a chest decompression. There's also wearable practice suits that have organs and ribs and lungs and things. And they're being, their instructors are there and they're being challenged to do all this while they're scared and they're at the fight, because the fight or flight response when, you know, you've got adrenaline, I mean, it's great if, yeah, it kind of makes you fast, strong, and dumb. It's great if you need to run away, climb a tree, lift a car off of somebody's leg. I mean, it's an amazing advantage to have, but if what you need to do is focus and operate delicate machinery and make decisions while people are, you know, screaming and firing weapons, it's very hard to do. It puts you at a disadvantage. So they try to do something called stress inoculation, where they give them a dose of that in a safe environment, and the hope is they'll be better able to cope overseas when they're deployed, when they're having to actually try to save somebody's life, because you have so little time. If somebody's bleeding, you've got a couple minutes if it's an artery bleed. So, I don't think any of them are overwhelmed in that they know, obviously, they didn't cut off somebody's leg. They know it's fake, but it is, because it's loud noise, the instructors are yelling, they're under a lot of pressure. I think they're just glad when that day is over, or 2 days. They're just glad when it's over. But it was intense, but not in any way overwhelming, or didn't really have a lasting effect. I think I was going to embed for this book, but it was because it was during the drawdown. There were very few embeds. I think in that scenario, things that I might have seen, of course, would have been completely unexpected, and I would have not been prepared for it. So, you know, that sort of scenario probably, yeah. But I not in my case, no. I mean, it was fascinating, and it was intense to see it, but not like lasting emotional damage or anything like that.
In addition to your research, which is amazing, your writing is just really compelling. And so I would like to hear a little bit about your writing process in terms of what things you find easy, things you find difficult, and how you work it in with all the research that you're doing.
Oh, sure. Thanks. The writing, my writing, if my writing goes well, it's because the reporting went well. If, you go on a reporting trip and you're trying to come back with an interesting scene, something that you saw, a story you can tell in that chapter, characters, dialogue. So if you come back with a really compelling pile of, it's like you gather these sticks, you know, and you come back and you've got this pile to then build something out of. And the writing, completely dependent on the material and how interesting, surprising, funny, strange, whatever it is. So my writing either goes really well and is really smooth and fun, or it's just a struggle because the material's a little flat and I'm trying to punch it up, trying to make it funnier, fresher, whatever, trying to make it sing when it's really off tune to begin with. That's a terrible analogy. But anyway, so I'm a writer who's really dependent on her research. And when it goes well, it's a joy. I love writing up a scene that may have been awkward to live. You know, the more awkward it is, the more fun it is to write. So, so I tend to write the narrative structure first, and then be like, science TK. Like, I'll stick some science here. You know, once I have the framework of the different scenes, then it's an easy process to go back and flesh it out with information and explanations. That's kind of how I tend to do it. And then I go back and fine-tune it, and I read it over a million times till I'm sick to death of it. And that's kind of how I do it. I love, you know, describing things. I love trying to meeting somebody, trying to kind of sum them up in a few sentences. That's a really fun thing to do. It varies from really fun to really frustrating, depending on a lot on the reporting and how well it went.
This is a really very much on the same line of thinking. How much of your time is spent research, and then how much are you going and then are you researching all the different chapters and then writing? Are you researching and then writing and then, and you're oh, that's kind of cool. I can maybe use that for something else, and just and taking notes as you go. And how does that work?
Yeah.
And another quick thing is that I told my friend that I was reading Gulp, a tour down, tour in the Alimentary Canal, and he's like, it's a little hard of hearing. And he's like, what country is that in? John.
Yeah,
I went
see,
down three times. I had to explain it to him. And after a while, I gave up.
Yeah, see, it worked. It sounds like a canal. It's like, let's come with me. We're going to take a trip down the Alimentary Canal. Good, I'm glad to hear that. Research and writing, when I've been on a reporting trip or I've been to an archive, in the case of a historical chapter, and I have the bulk of the material that I'm going to need to write that chapter, I write it right away as soon as I can while it's fresh. And that means, and I might not know where it's going to fit in, you know, I usually have around 15 chapters. And I don't necessarily know where it's going to go. I might have a sense of what might follow it, what might come before. And I don't worry too much about that because I can always change the transition from one chapter to the next and make it fit somewhere else. The idea of researching a whole book and having this massive pile of stuff that you then have to write up would be overwhelming. Though I know lots of authors, particularly if they're doing a narrative that's a book-length story all the way through, you kind of, in order to pace each section, you kind of need to know the whole story. So I just prefer when I can to write up, to see those pages piling up, even though they're not printed out anymore, just to have this sense of that I am actually making some progress. So often I'll pull something out of one and stick it in another. Yeah, it's a fair amount. It's an organic process and a lot of changing. I think I probably have 15 outlines that I write, and each one I think, now I know exactly what's in this book and what order it'll be in. And then a week later, I'll be, oh, that's ridiculous. What was I thinking? So I'm rewriting the outline many times over because I may come across something. When I start the book, I don't know that much about what I'm writing about, really. 6 months, 8 months into it, finally I have a sense of what the book's about, what fits and what doesn't. But in the beginning, I'm just sort of pulling at everything there's probably 10 chapter files that never went anywhere that I thought I would put in that didn't work out logistically or turned out to be kind of boring. And they're all in the back of the file cabinet. And so you just get used to that process of kind of flailing around for months and not really knowing what your, people say, what's that book about? I don't know. Not sure yet. Yeah. Yes.
Do you find it's letting it sit for months and while you do other chapters helps the read?
Yes.
Do you have to keep editing while it's still hot?
No. I think actually getting some distance from it. Sometimes I'll write a chapter and forget about it for a few months, and then I go back to it and I am able to see places that need attention that I couldn't see before. So yeah, definitely getting some distance from it helps. And having another set of eyes, having my editor comment is very helpful too. I mean, I don't have a lot of readers that I send it out to because I think I wouldn't, if you get, inevitably what happens when I send the book out to all of the people in the book for that I took up a day of their time or more, I send it to them and inevitably they tell you what's their least, their least favorite and their favorite chapter. There's never any overlap. Like this is one person, I thought this shouldn't be in the book. This doesn't really pertain to anything. And somebody else will go, I love that chapter on shark repellent. So it's really hard. If I had a lot of readers, I don't know what I'd be able to make that, who to listen to. Right. I just have to throw them all out probably. Yes.
So speaking of research, I was wondering if you, over the course of writing all of your books, if you have an interview that got away, if there was one person or organization that you wish you would have had the time, but logistics just didn't work out, if you could have, just spent some time with that group or that person and put it in one of your books.
Yeah. There were a number of things I wanted to do for Grunt. My editor had this, because of Zero Dark Thirty and other books like that, she's like, Mary, people are interested in the Navy SEALs. Can you go out on a mission with the Navy SEALs? I'm like, no. But she, you know, I'm such a dutiful author. I'm like, maybe, let me try. Let me see. So I call up Special Operations Command, Public Affairs Office, and I explain my situation. And here's what I thought would work. Special Operations, they've got weather people. And it's a really important part of a mission, the weather. But you can just imagine if you're somebody who made it into Special Operations, you're like a Navy SEAL or whatever you are, and you're that guy, and somebody goes, what do you do? And they go, oh, yeah, I'm Special Operations weather. You know, I just thought, like, the poor weather, I mean, it's a critical thing, but they don't get the glory. So I thought, okay, let's look, you know, I like to kind of shine a spotlight on people who don't really get a spotlight on them ever. And I explained this to the guy, and I'm like, he goes, it's classified. Are you crazy? I said, yeah, but I'll only talk about the weather. I'll just go like this. And there, you know, he's like, no, that's not gonna, so not gonna work. But that would have been an interesting. And I also had wanted to embed with the Chaplains Corps. The Chaplains Corps, Army, Navy, whatever, they all have them. And in the Army, they go out with units. They say they're doing like a route clearance, which, you know, your vehicle might drive over an IED. I mean, they're putting themselves at risk as well. The chaplain doesn't carry a gun, but the chaplain's assistant covers the chaplain. So there's like this team. And I thought, that's why I thought a PTSD chapter, that could be a kind of an interesting framework, because they seem in a position to empathize, because they've been through the same, you know, the day-to-day hardships and some of the risks. I thought that would be really interesting, the Chaplains Corps, you know, and not so much the purely religious element of it, but there were elements of that. I mean, okay, if you're Catholic, the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. How do you reconcile that with what you're asked to do as a soldier? So I thought that'd be really interesting, and I wanted to do that. But ISAF, which is the, you know, coalition organization, said we're not doing we're doing embeds for daily journalists, newspaper and radio, and we're just not doing much else. So there you go. But I thought that would have been really interesting. Yeah.
I have a friend on the West Coast, the Left Coast, as we call it.
Yes.
Who has read several of your books and said to me one time, everything that Mary Roach writes is good.
Oh, I like him.
He's also a grunt, a veteran of the Vietnam War, saw a lot of intense combat as a long-range patrol guy, has the wounds and the medals to show for it.
Yeah.
And when he heard about this conference this afternoon with you, he said, please ask her, what do grunts say who have read the book Grunt? What do they say to you about it? What should I tell them?
The lovely thing about writing a book is that when people like it, they tend to give you feedback. And when they don't, they go on Amazon and trash you in some way. And I don't read my Amazon reviews anymore. I've gotten nice feedback. I've gotten really nice feedback actually from some of the veterans groups. You know, not necessarily, I mean, I don't know exactly, you know, what role in combat, if they were infantry or Marine or whatever. I haven't gotten a lot of specific, you know, grunt specific feedback. So I don't have a very good answer. My hope is that they've enjoyed it, and the people in the book have given me nice feedback. But a lot of them are scientists, and people involved, not the grunts. So, I would love to get more feedback from Marines and infantry. My sense is that they don't have a lot of. I mean, there's a lot of downtime, but they're, you know, it's a hardback book. I carry a hardback book with you. I don't know how many of them actually have bought it and read it. I really don't. I would love to know.
Okay, so thank you.
I'll tell him to read it, and he can let me know what he thinks.
Any more questions before we switch over to book signing?
I was just curious. I think everyone in their life has a turning point after which nothing is ever the same. And leads them to a certain path. Can you identify your big turning point?
In my career, I guess the turning point was that moment where this wonderful agent contacted me, wrote to me, and said, do you ever think about books? And I said, no, I don't think that that's something I could do. And the fact that he persisted and said, let's just have an open-ended conversation. You know, let's, if you get any kind of an idea that you want to talk about, you know, call me and let's talk about it. Let's sound some things out. This person just dropped into my world and, you know, everything changed. And from that point forward, I wrote books. And I really enjoyed magazine journalism. I liked that portion of my life, but I never went back, really. I still occasionally write magazine pieces, but it was just a 180-degree turn, and off I went. And I had nothing to do with it, really. You know, it was his phone call. And I think around that time, I got a fortune that said, try something new. So I still have that taped to my wall. I mean, that sort of gave me a little bit of courage to try that, because a book is a scary, for someone like me who's never done really long, extensive, heavily reported magazine features. You know, I tended to do 3,000 words or less. It was a scary thing to take on 80,000 words. Like, how do I do that? So anyway, I guess that was a real...
Okay. If I may, you touched on one thing that kind of... Michael Pollan does a lot of the serialization where he would issue a chapter in the New York Times.
Yes.
And then turns around, that chapter shows up almost verbatim in this book.
Yeah.
Yes. You had some occur a little
yes.
bit, but is that not a generally, I'm not keeping track, is that a business model that works for some writers still?
That's a really interesting question. For some books, there's been four or five chapters that have appeared in various publications, but there reaches a point where if you put too much out there, there's a sense that like the whole book could, I mean, people have read enough, they don't need to go any further. And I think, you know, I see that happen sometimes, a New Yorker piece. You know, I read the New Yorker regularly, and I'll read a, 5,000, 6,000 word piece from a book, and I'll really enjoy it, and then I'll go like, okay, I'm done with that. That was enough. And I think that's a danger. It does put the word out, and a lot of people hear about it. I think it's a, you could kind of make the argument either way. And I don't know, as a business model, if anybody's quantified, how does that affect, does it pull in more readers than it puts off? I mean, not puts off, but people thinking, yeah, I'm good. Swimming in Antarctica, 5,000 words, I'm good. You know, I don't know. My extracts or excerpts have been in like Popular Science, Outside. Where else have they been? You know, they're not sort of New York Times, Science Times. So I think they're not huge profile enough. I think it's probably been a good thing, but I'm of two minds about it. I think you can do too much.
Oh no,
they always try to. The reason mine haven't appeared in the New York Times Magazine or the New Yorker is because it's me, and I'm like not quite the right tone or whatever. I think they would love to. Your agent at my agency, William Morris, there's a excerpts person who sends it out everywhere, and so does Michael Pollan have such a thing. So it's I think the tendency is to grab whatever you can, because it really lets people know. And in the New Yorker, interestingly, it doesn't say at the end, this is an excerpt from a... You just noticed that 3 months later, oh, hey, I read that piece. Yeah. Hopefully by then you've forgotten what you read.
Yeah.
And you'll go, oh, yeah, I want to read that again. But yeah, no, I mean, people like Michael Pollan are regularly, their debut is marked by an excerpt. I'm not Michael Pollan.
All right, this is going to be our last question.
This is, in the book, Stiff, when you were... researching that, I also saw in Bonk you brought up also cadavers or heartbeat cadavers, and in our society, both sides, life and death, are becoming greater and greater issues. Did they have a clear definition of death that you came across in Stiff?
Yes, it's brain death. That's the legal definition of death. It's done by, but for centuries it wasn't clear, and it was done by heartbeat, and then around the time of the first heart transplants, there were lawsuits, and huge medical ethics question. There was a concern, like if somebody's brain dead, okay, they're legally dead, but before there was the legal definition, do you allow someone to go in and take that heart? And if so, is that person committing murder? Because there wasn't a a clear-cut definition that, like, okay, brain death. We can say this person, because they're brain dead, is legally dead, and now, therefore, you can take their heart and transplant it and save a life, and you're not killing them. But those first heart transplant surgeons were, murder cases, there were lawsuits. I mean, it was a really interesting kind of fraught time before there was any real consensus. Yeah, like that there's flatlining. You can look at somebody's EEG, electroencephalogram, and tell the difference between somebody who's healthy, sleeping, comatose, dead. I mean, there's a spectrum, but it's still, you know, it is still frightening for families to trust that definition and to feel confident that this person's not going to recover. Because there are cases, you know, there are cases where people think they're dead and they're actually, there's gradations. And then for you as the family to say, yes, it's okay to take the organs, there's concern, like, did we just kill them? You know, was there a possibility, however slim, that they might have woken up? It's very rare in those cases don't come up a lot. But anyway, it's a difficult thing for that reason sometimes for families to say, yes, you may, you know, take the organs, because then it's really the end, and then there really is not even you can't even hope for it. So anyway, yeah, it's, sure. Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking
with
us.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.